Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means taking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hello and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. And no, this is not Rob Moore. This is producer Harry. So Rob is extremely busy at the moment, as he always is, but he is working on some really exciting projects, which mean he's in and out of the office constantly. So I've got to come in and tell you guys, set the scene for what this special episode is all about. So this is our 400th podcast episode on the Disruptive Entrepreneur, which is an absolute phenomenal achievement. When I first started working on the podcast, it was probably only about 6 months old, so that was over 3 years ago. We weren't that many episodes in, maybe about 40-odd episodes at the point. So in that time, you know, we've met some absolutely fantastic people, some fantastic interviews, we've produced a lot of great content, and we've grown this from absolutely nothing to where it is now. We've got, you know, millions of listeners. We're listened to all around the world, over 400 episodes now. It's a really massive achievement. However, it's not possible without you, the listeners, the guys who tune in, week out, who want to listen to Rob and his message and, you know, learn something, improve yourself, whether that's your business, whatever that may be, your mindset. And we're really thankful that you guys tune in and have made the podcast what it is. So we wanted to have a celebration for this 400th episode. We gathered some of our most popular guests, and we had a live event. Probably about just under 100 people came to the event. We had Jake Wood from EastEnders, who's been on the podcast before, who's become a really good friend of Rob's. We also had Kevin Clifton, the big Strictly Come Dancer. He's been on the podcast before. I think this is his third appearance now, so that's a record for us. And we had Ricky Wilde, the music producer. Ricky Wilde kind of started his career in the 80s with Kids in America, that big hit, and he's progressed his career on. He's achieved some amazing stuff. So we had these three awesome guests and Rob kind of taking Q&A from the audience, and also kind of, you know, almost like what makes these guys successful, kind of, you know, a collection of really great people in their niches coming together. And we just kind of just wanted to have a celebration of this 400th special and just have a great time. And it was a really, really good event. We've got a little team now who work week in and week out behind the scenes, making sure that you guys get the best quality content. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who works behind the scenes. There's kind of a lot of you to name you all, but you know who you are. Thank you so much. You know, it's not just me. There's a whole team here, and these guys work super hard, and they do it for you guys, the listeners. So thank you to the team. But a massive, massive thank you to all our listeners all around the world, all the countries that you guys tune in from, all the episodes that you've, you know, listened to, people who share our content, share the message, who follow Rob on all the platforms, you know, YouTube, podcast, Facebook, everywhere. Massive thank you from taking this podcast from nothing to now 400 episodes in the amount of time we've done it is absolutely amazing. So enough of me. Let's move on to the 400th special podcast episode. But one final thing from me. And remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
Peace.
Good evening, everyone. Yeah. How you doing? Yeah. Woo! Thanks for coming. Yes. All right. Welcome to the 400th episode. Yeah. Wow, rowdy bunch. Oh, shit. Right. So, yeah, I'm really excited. I've been like a kid in a candy shop for the last few weeks thinking about this. Two of the most successful people in their fields, two of probably the biggest celebrity names in the UK in their fields, maybe even in all fields, have agreed to come and be your special guest at the 400th podcast episode. And I think
It's a real privilege that we all get to spend time with these people. I feel really privileged that they've become really good friends of mine since, well, Kev, we go back a bit further because we've got a property and business relationship when Kev got into property. But really, it's my work with them on my podcast that kind of kicked everything off. Jake Wood has his very successful podcast, Pound for Pound. Kev's podcast is launching before the Strictly show, the Kevin Clifton show. We went down to Southampton where he was doing one of his shows and did three episodes with him. So this really is all in about podcasts. So I want you to be involved as much as we're involved, which means that certainly for, I would say, at least a third of each of the interviews, I'm going to open the floor to questions. So I'm going to give you a little bit of time to prepare what your one question might be. Now, we're theming tonight on secrets to your success. Because actually, Kev's been interviewed twice on my podcast before. He's one of only maybe four or five guests that I've interviewed twice. Kev's got a great story. He's done many great things. And he's very honest and open about some of the challenges he's had in his journey. But I want to make sure the interview with him tonight is a little bit different from what you've had on the podcast before. And whilst we did talk a bit about Kev's success, we talked more about his journey. We didn't really get into what makes him a great dancer, you know, what made him win Strictly after five or six or seven goes, what does he think makes an amazing dancer, etc. And I'd like to theme it like that, just so that the 400th and the 401st and the 402nd episodes that come out, they have a little bit of a unique flavour to them. We also have another special guest. Now, I invited Aston Merigold, JLS, and Yanni, who's got a huge YouTube channel, who is the rap guy who's massive in cars. They both said yes, but they couldn't do this one. Aston said, book me in for the 500th. So I'm doing 500 episodes every day to get that one in quick. but someone who's coming today, his sister is wildly famous. And he is in her band and he writes her songs. And I've got to know him recently. He is the most lovely man you'll ever meet. He's just started a podcast. I've been advising him on that. So he's coming up with Jake. Literally, Jake's been filming all day and he's driven straight up. So, you know, Kevin is a really busy guy. He gets one day between his current tour before he's on to Strictly. So that's like a full football season, one day off, full football season. So Jake has been filming all day, gets in the car and comes up here. So I know you're all excited. I can sense you're all excited. But these guys have really delivered for us. And, you know, they're not getting paid. They're just doing it because they love podcasts and they want to help our community. So, Kev, I'm really grateful. Thank you. Really appreciate it, mate. Let's give Kev a huge round of applause. That wasn't actually your intro, but just come up. But come up anyway, that's all right. Now, as you can see, I've got no questions. I want it to be really conversational. But Kev, the first thing I would like to know is, what, you've been dancing since you were four, correct?
Yes.
And you are now 36. Yeah. So you've been dancing 32 years.
Yes.
You must have seen some amazing dancers and many dancers who were good but didn't quite make it, and many average dancers.
Yeah.
What makes the best dancers?
I think the best dancers are the ones that they've got a sort of a good grasp of technique, like they've worked and worked and worked, but that'll bring you to being a good dancer. But the best ones are the ones that can connect with people on an emotional level. So to me, it's the ones that can make you feel something. And I suppose like any arts, like with acting or singing, I suppose even if you imagine like your favorite singer is not necessarily the greatest technical singer in the world, but there's something about the music, there's something about a certain song or something that makes you feel something.
Well, you, one of your favorite singers is Robbie Williams, isn't he?
Yeah.
Who maybe not the best technical singer.
No, but like I really feel something like when he's with his songs or when he's performing. And so for me, the best dancers are the ones that have that ability to. Yeah, to make you feel, that can connect emotionally with you.
Yeah. And so, on Strictly, Is it different? What makes a winner of Strictly different to what makes a great dancer? I know the answer is yes, by the way.
Yes. Are you talking in terms of the celebrities doing it or as us pros?
Well, just tell us. We've got all night, mate. Okay. Tell us all.
Well, in terms of the celebrities, like, I don't know. Like, it depends on who the audience get behind, really. And that can be many different things. I think people watch Strictly, and I think a lot of the time they like to see someone who wasn't necessarily brilliant at the start, and they have to work really hard, and they see a lot of improvement. And also, like I said, with just being a dancer, that they want to connect emotionally. I think people get bored of watching someone who's just kind of perfect in terms of technique and lines and things. They don't want to be given a display of something. They want to get excited by it. So yeah, and with the pros, like if I was to do, I haven't done been in the dance competition world for quite a while. I stopped doing that in 2007. So 12 years now I've been out of the competition scene. If I was to go and do competitions nowadays, I probably wouldn't get anywhere, whereas I used to be quite successful in it, but I probably wouldn't get anywhere because it's judged in a very sort of technical way. You have to satisfy this and tick that box and whatever. Whereas on if some of the top competitors in dancing competitions, if they were to cross over to Strictly Come Dancing, I think a lot of them would struggle on Strictly because I don't think they would understand that, like I said, the audience are looking to get excited. The audience are looking to feel something with what they're watching. They don't want a technical display of sort of expert movement.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's sort of two different things. Like, and I mean, I've been trying to win Strictly for years. It only just finally happened.
Not that it matters.
Yeah.
Oh, it's all about the celebrities. It's nothing about the dancers.
Yeah, I've been saying
no,
that.
Nothing about us.
Yeah, for 6 years I've been saying, you know, it's all about the entertainment. And it's all about the audience. And it's all about the show. And the winning really doesn't mean anything. But, like, that moment when they called out our names in the final was a pretty good moment. But, yeah, I think... You know, I think that was probably the combination of, you know, the pro and celeb. I was dancing with Stacey Dooley on the last series, and and
Kieran, shut up,
man. And I think people took to her because she was just like very normal. People could. It's about relating to people, isn't it? Yeah. All the time in anything. It's the same with, like, I don't know if you're interviewing someone or anything. It's just about like relating to someone. I think people related to Stacey. She was a normal girl. People see themselves in her going on that journey of trying to work as hard as possible at this new skill and just doing her best. And she did work hard. She really improved. I think she sort of displayed that. Like the first couple of weeks, we were doing, 8 hours a day training, and we were getting 4s and 5s out of 10 from the judges and sort of not doing as well as we'd like, and she just went, "Oh, I don't want to get kicked out early. Like, I'm really enjoying this. I want to do better than this. So I think we need to put more hours in." And we ended up doing 14 hours a day of training, and her improvement just went through the roof. She just kept improving and improving, and I think people like that in someone. And then, I don't know, with me, it was probably a bit of a sympathy vote that went along with it because I'd been runner up 4 times. So people were probably thinking, yeah, I really like her. She's really hardworking. She's doing a good job. And she's dancing with him. Just give him it. Give him the win just once. he's paid his dues. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of factors go into it when it comes to Strictly specifically.
So popularity, liking to see someone work hard, like to see them improve, not necessarily perfect, relatable, make you feel something.
Yeah, I mean, there were two girls in the final, one of them from the Pussycat Dolls and one of them from Steps. Both lovely and both brilliant dancers, but they were brilliant from week one because they were professional dancers before their pro partners were professional dancers.
Could you argue then it was harder for them because the expectation was higher?
I think it was easier for them to get to the final. But when it came where the judges have nothing to do with it and it's just down to public vote in the final, I think they had a big task on their hand to convince the public to vote for them to win.
Yeah.
I think everyone loved them and enjoyed what they were doing. Nothing had, no one had anyone against them, but to inspire someone to get behind them and it's a funny thing in this country. I think we love an underdog. Someone's really good from the beginning. We immediately take against them.
Yeah.
And it's like, we want someone who's not great, but they're working really hard. Like we champion hard work here, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it on Strictly. Mm. Yeah.
So in your shows, Burn the Floor, Rock of Ages,
yeah,
where you have maybe a bit more creative license.
Yeah.
Do you work on the emotional connection part? Is it something you're really thinking about? How can I move these people and make them feel something?
Yeah, more than anything.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the main ingredient for me. It's linking emotion to everything, because
yeah,
then people will go along with it. Like I said, people's favourite song usually is a song that relates somehow to a certain feeling or memory.
Mm.
And I think Tony Robbins does a lot of that sort of work. Like he gets you to link emotion to a certain thought or desire or something that you want to achieve. So it's not just like, oh, I'd like to achieve this. It's like, what would it mean to you? What would happen to you if you don't achieve this? Or you know, and how would it change your life if you do achieve this? And like, put yourself in that position. How would it feel? Like, that's what Tony Robbins is doing when he talks about stuff. So it's all about linking emotion to stuff. So when I'm going out as a performer in anything, whether I'm acting, singing, dancing, my main aim is to make people feel something. And it's less important, actually, say, like when I'm singing in Rock of Ages, it's less important to me, like, whether I hit that note perfectly or whether my voice is a bit rough that night or whatever, as long as the audience feel something, as long as they get excited, they get emotional, you know, they get you know, they get goosebumps or like whatever the thing is, or they're laughing because it's comedy.
Yeah.
As long as they feel something, then they're hopefully gonna enjoy it or be inspired in some way, or
yeah
get excited, whatever the thing is. So it's all about that emotion for me.
Yeah. So I'm a great student of really successful people, and I don't know if you've watched this yet, Kev. I know many of my community have, but on the 2nd of January, I watched a documentary on Alexander McQueen called McQueen.
Right, I haven't seen it.
Really moved me. One of the best designers that ever lived. I think he was the head of Givenchy at 19 years old, the head designer. It was just like unheard of what he achieved.
Mm.
And throughout his life, he got a lot of criticism for his work because it was quite dark, a lot of skulls, a lot of death, a lot of darkness in his design. And he said pretty much exactly the same thing. He said, you come to my show, I don't care if you love it. I don't care if you hate it. I just want you to feel something.
Yeah.
And I think he really needed that. And I think humans really need that.
Mm.
And you watch an amazing Netflix documentary or, you know, you're moved or inspired by someone or a film or a hero. I think it's spot on. It's because they make you feel something. They make you feel alive. Because alive is not just about feeling good. It's also about feeling sad. I mean, some of the best music in the world is some of the saddest music in the world. And so do you see that as your job as a dancer and an entertainer to take them on like a journey?
Yeah.
Are you looking for lows as well as highs?
Yeah. Well, like when I'm teaching my celebrities on Strictly Come Dancing, I encourage them to go all in on something, to like give absolutely everything to a performance. Like don't ever play it safe. Don't ever try and sort of hold back in any way in the hope that like it might not be the best that I can do it, but it's not going to be a disaster. You know, like being scared of it being that disaster, that's what I want to shy away from. And I always say to them, like, I would rather, so for those who don't watch Strictly, we get scored out of 10 on Strictly by the judges for each performance. And I say to my partners, like, we aim for the 10, obviously, but I would rather you get a 2 than get a 6. Because I think if you get a 6, it's sort of, it's safe. It's all right. It's fine. You got through it. You did okay. It wasn't brilliant, but it wasn't a disaster. Whereas if you get a 2, at least I feel like people got something to talk about.
You were shit.
Yeah. people are going to remember you. You're on some sort of journey. Like you're saying, you're on some sort of journey if you're getting a two.
You're at the bottom.
Yeah, you're at the bottom. You've got somewhere to go, because then next week we can come back and if it's, yeah, you get a three, yeah. But then if we get like an eight or a nine a couple of weeks later, yeah. It's like, oh my God, look at that. Look at that look at that improvement, you know, all of this. Whereas if someone's got a six and then a seven and then an eight, then they're already there. Or especially if they're all just getting eights right off the bat. It's like, where do you go?
And I suppose to get a two, thinking about it, there'd have to be some kind of disaster, which might mean a major fall.
Mm.
And to make a major fall, you might have to try a hard move.
Yeah, exactly.
It's about risk.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You've just got to go for it. Like I think, which dance was it with Stacey that we did? Samba, which was sort of, she wasn't a natural Latin American dancer. At the start, like a couple of weeks earlier, was when we were getting fours, doing a cha-cha-cha, and she was real nervous about the samba because it's probably sort of the most similar dance. And she was like, you know, she was asking me, is there something that we can do that sort of just make sure I get through it and safe? And I'm like, absolutely not. I said, so we dressed her up in a dress full of feathers. There was feather fans everywhere. It was like, everybody look at this and take note of this is going to be a massive performance. And I said, just, I want you going absolutely flat out, energy, energy, energy. I said, I don't care if the technique is all over the place. I don't care if there's like steps going wrong. I want you going flat out energy and have an amazing time, because I think people will really enjoy it if you just go for that.
Yeah.
And people did enjoy it. And, you know, technically there were issues everywhere, but then people started getting behind her because they were like, look at her having a go. And I think a lot of people just thought, you know, I want to, That's what I'd hope to do if I was on that journey on Strictly, and people were relating to her. Whereas there might have been a slightly better dancer that week, but they got forgotten about because they weren't all in.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like just all cards on the table. Go, bang, flat out, give everything you've got. Like, go there.
Well, I guess if someone like Alexander McQueen says, I don't mind if you love me, I don't mind if you hate me, I just want you to feel something, and you're saying, I don't mind if you get a two as long as you don't get a six. It sounds like what you're saying is the extreme ends of the emotions are where you experience life, where you can have a comeback from a failure, and maybe where you get remembered. That middle ground of anything, does it get remembered? Does the middle of anything get remembered? I don't know.
And I've got my haters. Like
you couldn't have any haters.
I've got so many haters.
But you are lovely.
No, like... But I'm just learning to
What do they say about
forums
you?
Or, you know, what's social media stuff?
What's the worst trolling you've had?
Horrible.
What's the worst you've had?
The worst?
Because I've had some good ones, mate. I've had some good ones. These guys know. Has anyone ever called you a bitch licker?
A bitch licker?
That's what they called me. I had to look it up in the dictionary.
Was it there?
Yeah, it means something.
Does it?
On the train back, I'll let you have a look at that.
What's some of the things?
Dick Ryder, have they ever called you Dick Ryder?
Dick Ryder.
Yeah?
No, not that either.
Wanky as fuck. Apparently some of my videos are wanky as fuck.
You've really got your haters, haven't you?
I have. Love me or hate me.
I had one of them that I read, which was quite funny, was that it said... Kevin Clifton's wig is terrible. I was like, I'm not wearing a wig.
But like, I'm 36.
So I get that. And then, you know, it's always like, you know, he looks like this and he looks like that. Like, just, you know, they attack the way you look and or the way you talk. You know, stupid stuff like that. And people come up, if they just don't like you, they just don't like you, and they'll come up for reasons why. Oh, he's the golden boy. The BBC are doing everything just to make him win. He's the favoured one all the time. Blah 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 blah. And I'm like, I wish I would be, because then I would have won already. Like, instead of coming second, nearly every year. But yeah, there are some.
If you love to travel like me and you understand the power in escaping the money for time exchange trap, but you just don't know how to do it, then building an Airbnb consultancy business could be exactly what you have been looking for. Right now in the UK, there is a completely untapped opportunity through helping struggling Airbnb hosts by turning around their underperforming properties and generating you huge commission payments in the process. We are going to teach you all of the tools and all of the techniques that we've learned over the last 5 years through building our very own multiple six-figure Airbnb business, arming you with everything that you need to swoop in and save the day. Minimal startup costs, zero risk, and almost unlimited potential. Sound good? Welcome to the Airbnb Consultant. Contact us through any of the channels included in the studio notes to get the conversation started.
We're sort of sat here and to talk about how to be successful and all that sort of stuff. So what I want to tell you, everyone, is no, you don't let that stuff bother you. But of course it does. Like, you can't. I'm human, you know. Like, so when you read it, you
but
read.
But if they don't know you, why does it bother you?
Well, what? Yeah, why does it? But for some reason it does. I know that it shouldn't. Like, I know sort of the stuff, but I'm not great at it. Like, I do read it sometimes, and it's like an addiction sometimes. It's like you just search out that. Like, you can have loads of nice comments on social media, and you'll just keep scrolling until you find that one. That one that's had a go at you and made you feel horrible. And then that's all you can think about, like, for the rest of the day, and you can let it ruin your day. I know I shouldn't look at it, but yeah, of course it does. Like, of course it can affect you. It's just how you go forward from there, I suppose.
I mean, as you've got more successful, you must have more.
Yeah.
So do you think you've got better at handling it?
Probably in the last year, like 6 months to a
because
year.
Because you've been in the press a lot more.
Yeah, I've just, been thrown in the deep end, I suppose. Yeah. Like, it's one of them things, again, where what I feel like I've experienced a little bit is while I was that guy that was coming second all the time on Strictly, I never really had that much problem, like from the press, for example. They quite liked me and they championed me because I wasn't the tall, dark, handsome, muscular, good-looking guy that was just winning and you know, winning at life all the time. I was like pasty kid from Grimsby who couldn't quite win. So everyone was all right with me. Everyone was fine. We like him. We like pasty little Kevin. But as soon as we won, that it turned. Like I suddenly started experiencing, you know, like they just wanted to find stories and take things out of context and write stuff about me. And I've read so much stuff about myself in the last sort of 6 months that has nothing to do with any kind of truth. They just make stuff up. Always an inside source says. And it's like, well, it's you, isn't it? You're the inside source. an inside source saying something is just a person saying something, isn't it? Like, if I go right here now, like, even in front of anyone, or even if I just said it to one person, Rob Moore's a bitch licker. That doesn't mean Rob Moore is a bitch licker. It just means someone said something. And if that person is a journalist, then I could be an inside source said. That doesn't make it true.
You might be starting something here, though. Yeah. After that happened, someone sent me a T-shirt with hashtag bitch licker on it.
Really?
And then Bobby said, what does bitch licker mean, David? Oh, so you've got better at handling it because you've been forced to.
I've just had to, yeah. It's one of them things of, like, just... I couldn't run away from it. It was just there constantly. And then some people believe it. Like, some people feed into this sort of gossip and stuff. So then I get messages on social media, Kevin this and Kevin that, and they know nothing about anything. But then suddenly I'm just being bombarded with all these messages from people. Mm. Usually, you know, it's just some sort of faceless person on Twitter where they don't put their names, just a load of numbers or something.
Yeah. And how do you clear your mind of that when you're about to do a show or, you know, you need to step up?
Well, what's been really nice is that, like, I've been on tour for all of this year so far, and I always come out stage door and see people afterwards, you know, if anyone just wants to say hello or you know, take a picture or whatever. And actually what I've found is people in general, actually, people just when they're face-to-face are nice. People are actually decent. It's just sort of this online culture of you know, faceless trolling type stuff where people feel like they can just have a go or say something. And the press just want to sell newspapers, and they're not gonna sell a newspaper by saying Kevin did a good show today.
Yeah,
you know,
at the front of the Sun.
Yeah. Like, no one's gonna buy it.
Yeah.
So they have to find something that sort of feels controversial, and you know.
Yeah.
So they just twist anything into something that sounds controversial.
Yeah.
And anything that'll do as clickbait and stuff. And the more I've seen it, the more I'm starting to get immune to it. It's just, yeah. I guess it's like anything. The more you practice anything, or the more you get, you're just thrown into something, the more you get used to it. Like when I first came here, when I first came to Progressive and was doing all sorts of stuff, I went on one of the courses. I've done sort of a few of the courses, and I went on the course that was about speaking. The speakers, you know, how to do speeches and stuff. I can't remember the name of it, but I came here and I was sat at a table with just like one of these round tables with a group of people, and we were sort of saying hello to her. And I was like really shy, and people were going, oh, you know, hi, and what's your name? Oh, my name's Kevin. And this lovely lady next to me asked me, and what do you do? What? and I said, oh, I'm just doing some normal buy-to-lets. And oh, right, so yeah, property, yeah. What do you do? Are you full-time property? No. Oh, so you have another job? Yeah. What do you do? Oh, I'm self-employed. because I'm on TV, the perception would be that I'm like mad confident. I'm not at all. Never have been. And I couldn't bring it. It wasn't within me to say to her, well, I'm one of the most successful professionals on Strictly Come Dancing. Did you not see my hips as I walked in?
Mate, you have practiced that, definitely.
But I was sat there.
You got the ladies blushing at the front, mate.
I was sat there going, yeah, I'm self-employed, and she, oh, okay, and then she asked me, so what is it that you do? Oh, you know, just you know, a bit of here, and I couldn't say it, and then in the end she said, I don't want to be rude. You don't have to tell me, but like you don't. What is it that you do? Because you seem quite like you don't want to say. And in the end, I said, "Oh, I'm a dancer." Oh, right. And then sort of left it there, and because I've been so embarrassed about it, she assumed like I was some sort of stripper. I was like, is it that kind of dancing that you do, like in the clubs? And I was like, no, look at me, of course not. Yeah, that'd be unsuccessful. That's why I'm here. But in the end, it sort of came about, and I said, oh, you know, have you heard of a show called Strictly Come Dancing? And she went, hang on, you're Kevin from Strictly Come Dancing. And then it went round the room, and everyone sort of got excited, and, oh, I know, yeah, and taking pictures and whatever. But at that time, I was really scared of sort of speaking like in front of people. Now it feels a bit easier. Like right now, I'm like, this didn't seem like a problem. Like before, a few years ago, I'd have been like really nervous and sweating and oh, I'm doing that much. I've worn the wrong t-shirt for that.
Right, everyone pop your hands.
Yeah. But it's like anything. The more you sort of throw yourself into something, and with property, like when I said, I had zero clue what I was doing, like how to go about being a property investor. You know, now I'm doing it.
Yeah.
It's like with anything, you throw yourself into it and just accept that you. I guess if you just accept you're not going to be perfect at it. So like with all getting all the trolling and all that, you just accept, you know, I've got no experience with this, you know, and you talk to people who have been through it before,
yeah,
like the whole, you know, mentor thing. So Rob's been mentoring me for a while. You one of the first things you said to me was like, if you haven't got any haters, you're not doing enough right. Mm. Like, which is kind of along those same lines, I suppose, of like throwing it all in and either the 10 or like the 2. You've got to go all in and go straight towards something. And I also just spoke to other people who have been in the position that have been on TV like a lot longer than I have and gone, how do you put up with this? Mm. And some of them say, oh, I just don't hear it. And and some say, like, it was the first time I had to deal with it. It was horrible. And you think that the whole world is talking about you, and you think that it's this massive deal. You place all this importance on it. But the truth is, no one cares. Mm. No one really cares. And that's probably a good thing to remember with any of it. Whenever you're feeling like worried about what anyone is thinking of you, like going into something or you're nervous about it, no one cares. Like 6 months ago when the newspapers were having a go at me about something, I was going, oh my God, I think everyone hates me. Everyone's talking about this thing that's going on in my life. The truth was, probably people would probably just scroll past it on their phone, went, oh, there's that guy, he's done something, and went on to the next thing, and then went to get their shopping, make sure their kids got to school, and then watch Netflix or something. Ooh. Like, they don't, people don't care. Probably, a massive percentage of this room probably didn't even know who I was as I'm walking onto this stage. So like, it's like, you feel like the whole world is caving in, but it's fine.
Well, I was hanging out a fair bit with you while that was all going on. I never read one inch of those columns. No idea what they were saying. Mm,
yeah.
So yeah, it's funny. We know what people are thinking, but
yeah,
they got their own problems. They got their own things to worry about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Than have your column inches top of their mind.
Yeah, and I'm trying to sort of keep relating to it, so it's not just all talking about dancing, but like the same, like coming here to Progressive, like when I was first sort of talking to people and trying to network, and I had no idea how to talk to people and talk to people about property, and I just had this like imposter syndrome of, oh, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know enough about property to be here. And you assume that everyone in the room is a property billionaire, and they know everything, every detail, about every law to do with mortgages, and tax and whatever. And you're completely out of your depth. And that if I say anything, people are going to think I'm an idiot. And they're not, are they? They're not. People just want to meet people, and they've got their own stuff going on and their own deals and their own, whatever, and they just want to chat about it.
Yeah.
So like, it's just getting that like imposter syndrome out the way. Mm. But it's always been there with me. It's always been a massive challenge for me. I think just recently I'm starting to get better at it.
So Kev's podcast will come out in, are you allowed to say when Strictly starts?
Yeah. Well, it comes on TV in September. Okay. With the pros.
We're getting your podcast out before Strictly starts.
Yeah.
That was the pact we made, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah.
So sometime...
The pact that we made about 2 years ago. I'm going to do a podcast.
When I said before Strictly, I didn't mean 2025.
Yeah. I'm going to do a podcast. No, I'm just going to procrastinate for a little bit longer because if I start talking, people are going to think I'm stupid and they're going to judge my podcast, and there's going to be loads of comments saying, I hate this podcast and I don't want to hear his voice anymore. Get rid of him. Hopefully that's not going to happen.
No, that won't happen, mate. So the reason I said that was because I was very proud that Kevin let me interview him for his first episode of his podcast. And he was very open about some of his imposter syndrome and stuff like that that he felt. So listen to that first episode, definitely, when it comes out in a few weeks' time. But back onto the theme of secrets of success. Mm. I know there's some people that you admire greatly, that you think are very successful. I know you've mentioned people like The Rock or Robbie Williams or, people like that. So whether you want to talk about specific people or general, what traits do you admire in other successful people?
The main one, hard work. And I know that's really, really obvious, but like when you see someone, I hate laziness. And when you see someone like The Rock, like he went from being sort of, he wanted to be an American footballer and went all guns blazing at it, but kind of failed. It didn't go the way he wanted it to. And then he became a pro wrestler. Mm. And he just worked and worked and completely conquered that world. And then he went on to make movies, and he's just worked and worked and worked and conquered that. And you see on his social media and everything, he's just relentless. Yeah. Like, and now he's such an entrepreneur. He's got all these businesses. He branches out, and everything he does seems to become a success. But because he just seems to be relentless in how hard he works.
Yeah.
I think what I admire in someone like Robbie Williams is, one, as a performer, he has that ability to connect emotionally, like we talked about. But also he's quite humble. Like, I feel like he has these sort of two sides to him. That's why I'm fascinated with him. He has this side of him that is over-the-top performer Robbie Williams, and people would think that he's arrogant. And that's this sort of ego performance side of character of him. But then you hear him being interviewed, and he's got all the same insecurities as anyone else, like massively insecure and worried about what everyone thinks and struggles with a lot of stuff. And I think when you hear people like him talking about that stuff, it's really cool because, yeah, you just realize, God, he's thinking all them same things that I was thinking. And because it's not just that people are born as these genius greats, like people have insecurities, like all the best ones have all these insecurities. Keep plowing through, keep failing, keep getting rejected, but keep going, keep working. And then just seem to become really successful. So, it's that ability to keep working past failure and rejection. Mm. Like, for me to get to me and Stacey winning Strictly on this last series, like, I got rejected by Strictly twice. Like, I really wanted to be a pro on the show. I got turned down twice until I finally got the job. And then I've been like so close so many times to winning. And then finally on my sixth year on the show, got there. It's become a long journey. And then to get in on the show as well, just because things aren't an overnight success. We were talking about this earlier, when people think that people can just become overnight success, there's usually years of work that's gone in before that. Like for me, I was dancing as a competitor, and then I joined a show called Burn the Floor, a dance company, and just worked my nuts off for years for that company. And the director of the show was a guy called Jason Gilkison. And we started off, we were performing in front of like no one at first. We were performing in front of about 15 people in a casino in Reno, Nevada. And then I remember once we performed in a theme park in Busch Gardens theme park in Florida, in front of one guy eating burger and chips. Like, and he wasn't there to see the show. He was there for the burger and chips. It just so happened that we were performing while he was there, and he was sort of half watching us. And that was my career as a dancer at that time. But it's every time, even if it's one person eating a burger, still go out and be all in. Mm. Go for that tent. Go, give everything you've got on stage that day. And we were trying to, you know, the show was trying to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And there was a chance that we might make it to Broadway. Once the show had become bigger, we were in San Francisco and we got told there's these producers in and they're looking to take the show to Broadway. And it all kind of hangs on tonight's performance. And we've spent a lot of money on this and whatever. If we get to go to Broadway, it's everything that the company's ever dreamed of. If they don't want us, we're bankrupt and the show will cease to exist. And at the time, I had both of my shins were full of stress fractures. As I'd had shin splints, but kept on dancing, and then they'd developed into stress fractures. And I'd seen this doctor while we were on tour in Australia, who was looking after like the Australian Olympic team or something. And he said, right, he took scans of my legs, and he went, right, here's a perfectly good leg, and here's a leg snapped in half. Both of your legs are about here right now. And I was like, okay, so what happens now? Like, what do I need to take, you know? And he went, you need 6 months off, 6-7 months of complete rest. And I was like, I can't do that because I'm going to miss out and we're trying to get the show to Broadway. And
So it gave me this machine that to do things that I had to stick my legs in every night, and I was taking loads of ibuprofen, and I'm sure it wasn't like the healthiest, but there was one night where Jason Gilkerson, the director, came to me and he said, right, and I was having a few shows off because of my legs. They were being very careful with me. And he said, tonight's the night, basically, we make it to Broadway or we don't. And he went, I know you're in pain, but I really need you on stage. Just can you give me tonight? I'll give you the rest of like the next few weeks off. Can you get on stage tonight? And I was really struggling. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And went on stage. And, you know, it wasn't just me. It's like the whole cast were working really hard. And we just went and gave everything that night. And we made it to Broadway. And the show went really well on Broadway. And I was working like solidly. Like it was so much work to stay there. We kept getting extended. It became a big success. Skip forward a couple of years later, I'm trying to get on Strictly Come Dancing. I got rejected on the first time I auditioned because I was an emo goth kid with long hair and black eye makeup and black fingernails, and they said we don't really have any need for a goth. So I cut my hair and smartened my act up a little bit, and you know, thought I'll try and look a bit smarter, like. Changed my image and went and auditioned again the next year and got told no again. And then the next thing that happened was they had one extra place on the show. They'd gone because they were like competing with X Factor, I think, and they wanted to make the show bigger. So it went from 14 to 15 celebrities. So one extra place opened up. And on that year, they hired Jason Gilkerson as their creative director of the show. And they said, We've got a short list of people like that we've seen. We need to hire one more pro. We're not sure about him. Da, 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 da. And like, so I'm told. So he's told me like in that meeting, Jason Gilkerson said, I don't know why you wouldn't hire him. Like if you hire him, he'll work really hard for you. And I got the job. And so it's like, it's that, it's just copying that work ethic in the people I admire, because like my dance talent clearly didn't get me the job. My dancing alone wasn't enough to get me the job, and they weren't happy with my image. So I feel like it was the biggest factor in me getting on Strictly was work ethic, and Jason vouched for me at that moment and said like he will work hard for you. Mm.
This is a question that's asked on a lot of podcasts that I try and avoid.
Okay. So suddenly it's going to get fired at me in front of loads of people live.
Yeah. But it's actually a good question. And I think it's relevant to the theme of secrets of success. If you could meet the younger you, maybe just starting in the pro world of dancing, what would the you now give advice to the younger you? Other than cut your hair.
Yeah. I'm big on this at the moment because I'm just been reading The Values Factor that you told me to read. I would say, like, just you've got to live your truth. Like, get in touch with what you want, and don't think that you have to pander to everyone else all the time. I feel very lucky that I've. Everything's gone well, and I've done well for myself. But I also think that I've probably wasted a lot of energy worrying what everyone else thinks of me, and as a consequence, living my life for other people all the time, and doing what I think I should do, as opposed to what I want to do, and you know, the things that I really hold like as my top values and priorities. Yeah. Like I should do this. It's only in the last year I've sort of started turning down choreography jobs because I've said I'm going to be this dancer until that point, and then I'm going to be this top choreographer, and panicking about it because it's quite stressful choreographing stuff. And then I've recently gone, oh, actually I don't think I want to be just a choreographer. I actually want to perform. So it's like, okay, so go and perform then. Like, who are you trying to impress? Like, trying to impress people with doing that. Like I turned something down just recently because I was close to accepting it, and then I figured out that the only reason, really, when I properly, honestly, was brutally honest with myself, the only reason that I was doing it was, or that I was about to accept it, was that so I could show off about it on Twitter. So I could go...
to all the trolls.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Like, we're laughing, but like, exactly, to all the trolls that go, oh, he's this and he's that and he can't do that. And I was going to go, and I was going to accept this job purely to go, yes, I can, look at me, I'm doing really well here. But the truth was, I didn't want to do it. Mm. And I would have stressed out about it, or like trying to impress your parents, or trying to, you know, impress a boss, or just, or some ideal that you've placed on yourself of like, I need to be this person.
Yeah.
If you're not that person, you're not that person. Mm. Like, you don't have to be anything. You be what you want to be. So I would say to my younger self, don't waste too much energy trying to be something that you don't want to be.
What a session so far. Please give Kevin a round of applause.
Thank you.
All right. This next one's a bit different. So Ricky's full name is Ricky Wilde. He has sold 20 million records. That is a lot of records. Yeah, 20 million. He's a songwriter, a producer. He's in a very famous band. They're huge in Germany. You may have heard of Kim Wilde. Have you heard of Kim Wilde?
Yes.
So Ricky is Kim's brother, but of course, also band member, songwriter, producer, a man of many talents. And I've really think he's a lovely man. I've been very privileged to get to know him over the last few months. And I'm really excited to see him. It was a total surprise. So please, could you give a huge round of applause for Mr. Ricky Wilde? Come on! Come on, Ricky! Take a seat. Wherever you like.
I'll sit here because I think Jake should sit.
Okay. How long have you known Jake, by the way?
Probably about 4 years, I reckon. Yeah, maybe longer. But me and my wife, we host a charity night every couple of years. And we heard that Jake had moved in about 5 or 10 minutes around the corner to where I lived. So we just dropped a little letter through the door saying, if there's anything you can donate for the auction. And bless him, him and Ali were really helpful. And now they come to... well, all our balls, and with Jake does the auction section for us as well. So, but we've just got really close through that, and then we started up a poker group, and there's like 10 of us all playing poker. So, and so we're all good mates now. Exactly, yeah.
Right, Jake, you ready? Yeah, you're all good. So, I mean, Jake obviously doesn't need a huge introduction because he's so famous already, but I think I should give him one. I think the biggest thing Jake's done in his life is come on the Disruptive Entrepreneur podcast. And he's not even listening. But obviously, a huge role in EastEnders. Really talented man in many areas. Really interesting, funny, fun guy to be around as well. So please give a huge round of applause for Mr. Jake Wood!
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. And congratulations on 401.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. 401. So yeah, this might be 401.
Right.
This might be 400.
Yeah.
I suppose it depends.
Poker.
When are we playing poker next? What do you think it takes to be one of the best actors in TV?
I wouldn't know. Ask David Jason.
Yeah. Or someone you've seen.
What does it take to be a great actor? Hard work, dedication, a stubbornness to want to succeed against every kind of every little bit of logic. I think it's in some ways it's a career you have to be driven to. Maybe like dancing, any artistic sort of venture, there's so many years before you get any rewards that in the face of that, everyone always looks at you. No, I met someone recently at a party about a year ago at a Christmas party. And she said, what do you do? I said, I'm an actor. And there's this little pause and she said, is that a proper job? I said, yeah, it seems to be working for Tom Cruise, you know? people know. there's always this perception, you know what I mean? But, you know, how do you monetize it, I suppose, is a thing. And is that your drive, or are you doing it because you're, you know, money was never my sort of my drive. I did it because I loved it. And I think, you know, I was always passionate about it. From the minute I started doing it, I started acting professionally from the age of 10, which is quite unusual. But I grew up in Islington in North London, and there was a very good drama club around the corner from where we lived, a woman called Anna Shear. And basically her drive, she'd set up this drama school in the 60s to get kids off the street in Islington, because it's quite a rough area. There's all these poor kids walking through the door. So you had Kathy Burke and Linda Robson and, you know, just these rough kids walking in off the street. And I was one of those kids, you know, so I went there when I was 10. And kids that got there, if you were lucky, you would get a little bit on TV. So when I was 10, I did my first professional job. And I knew absolutely from that moment on that was what I wanted to do. You know, of course, there's no guarantee at that point that you're ever going to do that job. It's one of those jobs that people, you know, thousands of people want to be actors, and there's no guarantee that you'll make a career out of it. It doesn't matter how much you want it, how much you desire it. You just, you know, you're going to have, you know, you need a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work, you know, and a bit of talent.
Yeah.
You're going to be humble, just like Jake is, just like Kevin is, because they're the kind of people you are. And so there must be some kind of serendipity about all of you being here at the same time. But if you could try not to be too humble for a little while, and what has made you so successful at selling so many albums? And I really admire people who last for decades. It's easy to last for a song or an album, but decades. Because you're like huge in Germany at the moment, you guys, aren't you?
Yeah, we had a new album out last year, and we've got another new album coming out in the next couple of weeks, a live album of the album that we recorded last year.
So I'll tell you how I can make this question different to how I did with Jake and Kevin. How do you become very successful for a very long time?
Fear, I think, for me. I was just petrified of having short-term success, and I was so scared of that happening that it just drove me to make sure that it didn't happen. So I think a lot of it was fear and insecurity, really.
And how do you balance that? Because fear and insecurity must make you feel all sorts.
Very anxious. Yeah, absolutely. And I did suffer with anxiety for a long time. But these days, I'm so much more relaxed in my life anyway. I don't need to prove anything anymore, and I feel very relaxed. I know what my limits are. I know what I'm good at, and I know my strengths. But I didn't know that when I was younger, so I was still trying to find the way. But a lot of it was fear. But also, I really sort of believed that I could make great records, and that was my real drive to make a great record.
Yeah, and is that fear gone away as you've had more success or felt more comfortable in yourself, or is it just still there?
I feel a lot better about it. Even now, I still get a bit nervous about working with artists when they come up to my studio. I work from home. I've got a home studio, and the artists come to me, and then we'll just sit in the studio and then start writing. It's a really interesting process because everybody's different, and you're almost like a psychologist working with a lot of especially vocalists, you know, when they're singing, because they're very, most vocalists are very insecure about their voices. So it's always, you know, just finding your way, but it's a lovely process when you go in the morning with nothing, and then at the end of the day you come out. I was playing Jakey a track that I wrote a couple of days ago with a girl singer called Nina. She's only young. She's got some stuff on Spotify. She's got a beautiful voice, and she's really beautiful. And her and her partner that she worked with, Laura Fares, both incredible talents. And so, yeah, they came up a couple of days ago, came up with a tune. I programmed it all up, got it all sounding great. And today, just sent it off.
Just in the car on the way up, Ricky was like, listen to this.
Really? And you'd done it that day?
It's a couple of 2 days ago, and then I finished
it. Really excited, yeah. Because she feels like it's going to be a hit.
She's really excited about it.
Can you tell when something
is going?
A proper, is that what they say? It's a proper banger.
It's a banger.
For me, that was a Vauxhall Astro. Can you tell when it's going to be a proper banger?
You kind of get feelings sometimes where you think
it's a banger,
it's got something.
No, it's a beautiful job.
I think it's got something.
But and I'm excited as well. Like, I must be the fourth person in the world to have heard it.
You are, actually. You are. Exactly. No one's heard it.
Okay. So, Ricky, I'd like to carry on exploring this insecurities thing because I do think, not yours necessarily, because I'm pretty obsessed with studying successful people. I'm like you, Jake. I love people. I love people I know and I love people I don't. It's like watching that McQueen documentary. I feel like he's like this spirit up there. I feel like a guy I know. I wear all of his clothes. I just, like, there's some kind of affinity there. And it's a people thing, not an individual thing.
I met him, by the way.
Did you?
Yeah. A friend of mine was his PA for many years. And I only met him once, but yeah.
But people think that successful people don't have insecurities. And you said something that I really want to explore. I think insecurities are inherent in successful people.
Yeah.
Like, I'll give you an example. If you're a public speaker and you don't care what other people think, you stand on the stage and you just talk to yourself and you don't really care about the audience or whatever. But to go on stage, you have to be a great speaker, you have to care about what people think to connect with them. But then when you care about what they think and you don't get the praise or the laughs or the adulation, you go off absolutely depressed. And Kev, you were talking about this, weren't you, with your performing. Kev basically, it's on his podcast, so you hear it, but every time he goes, he needs the energy and the enthusiasm for the audience. It'll come off like he's on a massive high if he gets it, and on a massive low if he doesn't. But Kev's Kev, and it's kind of even not really linked to the performance. It's linked to the response from other people. And I feel like in artists, in musicians, the pain and the insecurity and the suffering is what makes the great art or makes the interesting person.
Yeah.
And I'm well into art and creative stuff as well. And I think people think, oh, well, in art and creative stuff, that's okay. You know, you've got to be depressed and then you can be Radiohead, or, you know, you've got to be a drug-taking rock star and you can be Ozzy Osbourne. But I think I can't see any successful person who's not battled with their own insecurities.
I think with my situation, my personal situation, writing for Kim, being my sister, And in the very early days, my father, who's a rock singer back in the 50s, Marty Wilde, and he had a few hits, but he was a great songwriter as well. And Dad and I wrote the first album for Kim. And so there was Dad and Kim, and it was like this whole, if I didn't come up with the goods, it wasn't just me I'm letting down. It's Dad and Kim, and it's family, and it's. I think that was an added pressure for me. But I look back on those days, and I was only about, I don't know, I was 18, I think, when I wrote Kids in America, and it's just like I look back on it, and after that, I mean, that it kicked off. It's number one, not over here actually, it's number two, but it's number one pretty much all over the world, and that was the first one of the first songs I'd ever written. So Mickey Most, who was then my mentor then, he owned Rack Records that signed Kim. He said, look, Rick, he said, you better go in and do an album. And it's just like, my God, you know, I'd never recorded an album, but I just recorded Kids in it, and it had become this huge success. So that was another added pressure. It's like we kicking off so high and then keeping it at that level. Ooh. So I look back on it now, I just think, how did I do that? And I really don't know, but it's the fear thing. It's that insecurity of like, oh my God, I've got to keep it going, you know. Yeah.
So, are there, Jake and Ricky? Are there either any people you really admire and why, or just certain traits and successful people you really admire, other than hard work, which we've already mentioned?
Who do I really admire? I'll tell you who I really admire. Dave Grohl, I think he's got everything. He's living the dream. He's making great records, fantastic. I mean, he was originally a drummer in Nirvana. Obviously, Kurt Cobain, everyone knows what happened to Kurt. And then he steps up to the mark, and now he's playing guitar amazingly, writing amazing songs, singing incredibly, but not it's not all that. That is kind of just touching upon what he's like as a person. And everybody you meet in the industry, they all say what a lovely guy he is. And even the, you know, you might get a chef in a restaurant go, oh, we had David Brolin, oh, bless him, he came in and he thanked us for the meal and all this. That's where I judge success.
Yeah.
And he's like one of the good guys. Mm. And I really, really respect that. It's not just the success, it's how he's dealt with it and how he treats other people.
Mm. Jack? I admire you, Rob.
Yeah. Oh, I do, yeah.
But the other thing is, I think it's important to let people know if you admire them. And I'm always telling people, I admire you. Yeah, I'm always telling Rick, I love him, and and Kev, whatever. But it's important as well. I don't think people share that enough.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I think it's important to pass it on.
I think it is as well, and also because I speak to people a lot on the phone, one to one. I have this sort of thing in my industry where if anyone's struggling, I'll give you 15 minutes no matter what's going on in my day, and the worse your shit is, the more emergency I'll make it. If you're standing on the edge of the bridge, whatever I'm doing, I'm on the golf course with my son, I'll stop and I'll give you a ring. And I've been doing that for a few years. It makes me feel really good. It's not something I'd tell people publicly. But you just saying you believe in someone or saying something nice to them, that can be the biggest thing to them. That they might not have had that for years. Yeah. And just someone that they, because I admire you, I admire you equally. For someone that you admire to say, hey, look, you're great, that could turn someone's life around.
Yeah.
Really powerful. Yeah. So I'll ask you the same question I asked Kev, and then we'll do some questions from the audience. The question that's asked on a lot of podcasts that I try to avoid, but for this one, I'm not. So, Jake, when you're just getting good at acting and known, I don't know whether you just get on EastEnders or you get your big role, what advice would you give yourself going back now?
It's interesting because I heard you ask Kev that question earlier, and I was thinking of the answer. I suppose, when you hear questions on somebody, you think, oh, how would I answer that? Is it arrogant to say I don't think I would give myself any advice? I don't know. I don't think I would because everything that happens is like I'm at this point. So I'm not sure how I would really change that or be qualified to sort of, because I'm really lucky and I'm always very thankful for what I've got. It's not a day that goes by I don't give thanks. I've got a beautiful family. I've got a job that I love. I've got beautiful friends. I've got people in my life that I admire, and so I'm really lucky. I would just. Crack on.
So your answer is f***ing crack on. That's a hard one to follow.
The younger me, when you...
Yeah.
Give me more than that. Excuse my language, sorry.
Drop the C-bomb, but I'm really at peace. Yeah. It's all right. Dom Jolly did that on our podcast.
Yeah. I apologise. Yeah. I forgot we were live. That's what it is. We swear a lot in our podcast as well.
That makes it all better, yeah. Ricky, would you say anything to the younger you just before you write that big song?
I would say don't be so hard on yourself. Yeah. I think I was pretty hard on myself. And enjoy the journey, because the whole journey was the best part of it, really. And I didn't really see that at the time.
Yeah.
It was just pressure, next year, pressure, album, next album. And I didn't enjoy it. And people look back and they say, God, you must have been having a great, you must have been, you're smashing it. And it's awful. The whole process was just non-stop stress. Just enjoy the journey, really.
Yeah. Can I just go back? Sorry,
please.
Go back to what you said about insecurities. Like, successful people have always got insecurities. I think everyone's got insecurities. Mm. I don't think it's just people in our position, actors, whatever, creative people. I think everyone's got those insecurities.
Yeah.
And for me, the key is like how you, because everyone's got them.
Mm.
It's how you manage them and how you, they are a fuel. I think if you can change that mindset and you know, I don't know how to do it. I don't know the best way to how to explain it. But if you use it as a fuel to drive you on, you know, everyone's got them. But I think you just have to. I think once you take that step into the unknown, it's not as scary as you think it's gonna be. You know what I mean? I've experienced that over and over again. I did Strictly. I've never danced before. I put myself in a boxing ring. I've never boxed before. You know what I mean? I'm always pushing myself beyond something where I think, that's a bit nuts. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're doing. But yeah. I think that's, you know, as I said, I think that's where the golden. I think everyone has got those insecurities. And, yeah, they're a very important part of driving you on. And they should be. Yeah. They should be, because they are that voice that says, you know, you're not good enough, or that drives you forward, or...
But as long as you don't let it destroy you,
that's
or
the
affect
thing.
Your...
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, and I don't know how to give...
creativity.
I don't know how to give someone the key to do that, but I know that's really what you have to do. Mm. I used to have a drama teacher, and there's a scene when you're acting sometimes, and it's really annoying that during a scene, you'll be going, oh, no, I've done that really bad. And then you be in the scene and you're still acting and you go, oh God, I'm so I look so shit. You know, you've got this return thing, and at dialogue. The same time you're trying to remember your bloody lines, and someone you go, oh, I didn't do that. Oh God. Oh, why have you got your hand in your lap like that? Oh my God, you look like you're touching your penis. Or, you know? You've got this voice, right? And it's constantly telling you that you're not good enough, and it's all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so I trained with a guy called Scott Williams, who's a brilliant teacher, and he said, look, it's fine to listen to that voice, but you've got to listen to it before or after your work. So do your work, just be in that moment, do your work, and listen to it. And his thing was that voice is always the voice of your mum or dad.
Yeah.
Is a parent.
Mm.
Now, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. Mm. You know. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know. So yeah, so I think that's something to bear in mind.
Mm.
You know, that little voice that says you're not good enough or whatever. It's not necessarily you, or because you aren't good enough. You are good. You are good enough. I think everyone's good enough.
Yeah.
As Kev said, everyone's a superstar. That's the same thing. Mm. Everyone is good enough.
Yeah.
But it's just managing. You have to separate that. You know what I mean? Yeah, you have to take that negative and you have to put it in a little box and recognise it for what it is.
Mm.
And you have to go on, you have to do your work, you have to push forward, you know.
Great. Thank you, Jay. It's funny when people talk about luck, because the things that they talk about are preparedness meets opportunity, i.e. when an opportunity comes, you have to be prepared. What about going and getting the opportunity? Kevin didn't wait to be invited the second time to get on Strictly. He went. And he auditioned for it the second time. So go and seek out opportunities. Go and find stuff. Go and ask questions. An area I've punched above my weight over the years is I've managed to meet some very, very rich people, because I just ask them if they want to go out for a coffee, and I just message them. And if I don't get anything, I Instagram them in a few weeks with a voice memo. No one can turn down a voice memo. You know, when you're on LinkedIn and you see a private message and it's a voice memo, you think, I know that's a pitch, but you still have to listen to it. And so, like, you know, yes, sometimes it's preparedness meets opportunity. Sometimes it's just keep on going for what you want until you get it. And look, I would never knock an actor who's a journeyman. Some people probably have had a better share of luck than others. I feel I've had a really good share of luck. I mean, I'm a white male, born into, you know, like two parents who didn't get divorced, who are still together. I lucked out. But when I failed in my life, it was because I felt a victim. And when I did all right, it was because I just kept going and sought it out. So anyone who's been failing for 10 years, fail for 15, fail for 20, fail for 30. There's a brilliant documentary called The Dawn Wall. I love documentaries because, like Jake, I love people. And at the end of the day, if you do want to better your life, we're all trying to better our lives, I think. Well, a lot of us. You watch other people who've bettered their life and you learn from them. And this film, The Dawn Wall, there's two.
Great film. Seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
So there's The Dawn Wall and there's Free Solo. They're similar. And they both, these guys, climb up the hardest mountain in the world, basically. You think of a mountain, you think, no, this is just a sheer face that looks like ice. And literally, they're like half of a finger holding themselves up. And there's this one section where a guy has to go across. And he fails hundreds of times. And he has to climb across, like stretching further than you can, one finger. And then he kind of has to go one finger, and he's holding two fingers like this. It's just unbelievable. I'm not into climbing. I just step on the mountain. I'm so lanky. I don't need all that. But wow, because he just did not give up on that wall until he got through it. And that's an analogy and reality. So just something to chuck in. I'm writing a book called Opportunity at the moment. So I've been studying luck and opportunity and stuff. So obviously not as successful as Jake and Ricky in their fields, but trying to figure it out like everybody else. Study the unified field theory. I think I'm going to put a section of that in my book. It's a little bit out there, but the unified field theory, to simplify it, is basically the past, present, and future, infinite, simultaneous actualities, eventualities, scenarios exist in this unified field. Thanks, everyone.